magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses and therefore themselves and everyone around them through his transformational training program. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see
what it shows. G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and my special guest this week is Linda Tellington-Jones. And I think most people who have been around horses either know quite a bit about Linda Tellington-Jones or have at least heard her name, but I'm going to read you a little bit of something off her website here. It says, "The pioneering work of Linda Tellington-Jones has its roots in a philosophy that sees all beings, human and animals alike, as reflections of a divine whole. The Tellington T-Touch method was first created 4 decades ago as a system of animal trailing, healing and communication that allows people to relate to animals in a deeper, more compassionate way. A way that furthers interspecies connection and honors the body, mind, and spirit of both animals and their people." So that's pretty serious stuff right there. What's interesting with this conversation with Linda is, you know, as you probably know, I'm always trying to figure out how people got to the mindset that they currently have. You know, that's what the Journey On podcast is really about. It's not what people are doing now, but the experiences they had that got them there. And the stories Linda will tell you right here will absolutely blow your mind. They did mine. So I hope you enjoy this chat I had with the lovely Linda Tellington-Jones. We're all good. Okay, well, so do you have any questions? And lovely to meet you.
You too. I have no idea. What you do. Rupert just said, you really have to contact this guy. He's amazing. So that's all I know.
Oh,
amazing.
Good. Thanks, Rupert. You have no idea what I do. Well, that's fun. Well, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you.
This is going to be fun seeing you have no idea what I do. You don't even need to know what I do. I'll give you the quick rundown on the Journey On podcast.
It's called the Journey On podcast?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
And it's somewhat related to horses. Most of the guests I have on here have something to do with horses, but it's more about how the things that happened to us that led us to where we are today.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
So why don't you, let's kick this off. Why don't you give us a little bit of a spiel about what you do today, and then we're going to unravel it and go back to the things that got you there.
Well, I am incredibly blessed to have an international organization that, I mean, it just happened from the horse angels, I believe. I have 22 books in 16 languages. And it's not that, it's just because I in the beginning, I was taken under the wing of a woman who had, she'd sold 750,000 of her books. And so when her publisher, when she suggested that she co-write this book with me, her publisher took it instantly. And the very first book way back was called Endurance and Competitive Trail Riding with my first husband, Wentworth Tellington, who was 20 years older than I. And really, I mean, he gave me a leg up because I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for him. And so it became considered the Bible in the endurance world for many, many years. And then my next book, I've been working with horses since I was 6 years old in the first grade, because I grew up in outside of Edmonton, Alberta, in a little place called Gibbons, Alberta. And I'm 84 years old. And in those days, we didn't have school buses. And so my dad went to a riding stable, and we were on a farm at the time, on my grandfather's farm. And my dad was helping him with raising pigs and wheat, and bought me a horse. Nobody ever taught me to ride. It just put me up on this horse and And the horse immediately took me back to the barn at a walk, fortunately. And so I rode to school 2.5 miles each way with my cousins until we moved into Edmonton, Alberta. And then I was really blessed to be like 1.5 miles from a really big riding stable with an amazing horsewoman, Mrs. Alice Metherell. So when we drove to the farm, because my dad had had bought milk cows and a herd. And so as we drove by, I said, can I take lessons? And my dad said, yes, if you get a job to work for it. So the next Saturday, I had an amazing dad. He dropped me off at the gate and I walked in and I asked Mrs. Metherell, if I was 9 years old, if I could trade work for riding lessons. And so she put me on a horse and, you know, I'd been like riding 3 years every day at that point. And so I never did have to clean a stall or do anything. I just rode horses because she had a group of really wonderful show ponies, and somebody small is best to be riding them. And so that was my job. So anyway, I grew up starting to show horses when I was in big shows, in these 9-day horse shows in Edmonton, when I was 12, and I was catch riding. And that just means in the stable, we had some really good horses, but the owners didn't feel like they wanted to be in front of a judge. And so I ride these horses and I was really successful, Warwick. And I know the reason, what I mean by that, I think I won more than my fair share, because when I got on a new horse, it wasn't a question, let's win this thing. It's like, what can we do together, you know, that will make you feel good? And that's a really different attitude. And my mother would sit on the edge of the ring. And these were like, this is a really big Edmonton exhibition. And I think it sat like 6,000 people. And every time I go around, she'd say, smile, dear, smile. And I'm so sorry that after she passed and crossed the Rainbow Bridge, I finally found out that when we smile, we activate our feel-good hormone, the serotonin. And when we do, thanks to the research that the Italians did like 25 years ago, it's known that how we feel affects the animals around us. And of course, HeartMath Institute also. I mean, our heart field is really big. So if we're in heart coherence, our animals just can enjoy it as much as we do. And thanks to my grandfather, actually, my attitude was, I want the horse to have as good a time as I have with the horse. And that just makes a huge, huge difference, you know? So I was very blessed. And when I was 18, I married a man 20 years older than I, went with Tellington, and incredible genius. And he attended the last cavalry officer's training the year I was born. And so he had an amazing background also. And my background with horses, with Mrs. Metherell, is I would ride every day, go and ride 2 or 3 horses after school. And every week during the winter, we would have 2-hour lectures with her. And, you know, it just gave me a really, really solid base with horses. And then when I married Wentworth, we moved to the United States, and we were, of course, in Canada at that time. And I started, you know, showing and training horses there. I was also teaching 8th grade social studies in a private prep school where my husband worked. And so I'm trying to, you know, what happened to me in 1960 and 58, we went in partnership with a guy in Los Angeles, and he wanted to be in the horse business. And so we bought a horse farm, amateur thoroughbred farm, bought a bunch of broodmares at the Los Angeles sale, which was really fun, and had, I don't know, we just had a way of being with horses. And in 1962, we left the partnership and we started the Pacific Coast Equestrian Research Farm and went, developed these like natural vitamins and developed the sea kelp for horses way before it was known in anywhere, and actually dried sea kelp on the coast of California at Las Osas and fed it to horses free feed. And we had a newsletter at that time, Ulrich, that the research farm, Pacific Coast Equestrian Research Farm newsletter, that went to 20 countries. And we had people visit us from all over. I remember we actually have a picture somewhere with a, I think he was either Korean or Vietnamese veterinarian. I think it was Korean, who had read about the studies that we had done with these natural vitamin minerals that we were cooking. And we were growing like sea kelp, not sea kelp, sorry. Oh my God. Come on, Linda. It'll come back to me. I don't know if that's the COVID memory or the 84-year-old memory. I'm not sure which. But so we had a summer school for kids to come. And one Christmas, we had a phone call from a woman in Los Angeles, and she was an adult, a beginning adult. And she wanted to know if she could come and take lessons with us, because the only opportunity for her for lessons in Los Angeles was with kids. And, you know, kids are so much faster than an adult learning to ride for the first time. So anyway, we did this, and we saw in those years, there was no adult training. No. And so we decided to start a 9-month residential school for riding instructors and trainers, which we did then in up in the mountains near Visalia, California, at Badger, California. And it was a wonderful school. We had students from 9 countries and 36 states who came to us for 9 months, and they had to have 10 years of riding experience. And I'm trying to think, you know, kind of give you an overview of where I began to think differently. And I think it was like 1972. I was, I married to like, I don't know, 16 years to Wentworth. And we had a very supportive separation, which he thought would happen at some point, because he was 20 years older, and we were friends till the day he died when he was 80, which I think is really important that we learn to, you know, people we've loved and lived with, like, why does it have to be unkind? Don't think so. So anyway, what part of the story would be interesting to you?
Well, so, can I interrupt here and tell you what part of the story would be interesting to me? So Rupert Isaacson had said, you've got to get Linda on the podcast. And so I've done some research, and you have like such a varied background, you know, the endurance background, your dressage background, you know, you've got a background in everything. But this is not that kind of podcast. This is not really a horsey podcast. This is really the other stuff podcast. And so I was thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to talk to this Linda Tillington Jones about? And then I was watching a YouTube video, and it was about opening to intuition. And you said that intuition is unlearned knowledge, and that knowledge is out there in the quantum field. And you said something about one of Greg Braden's books. And a couple of years ago in London, I went to a one-day Greg Braden, Dr. Joe Dispenza seminar. Anyway, so when I saw that, I'm like, okay, that's what the podcast is all about. It's that, because, you know, you have every right to be that grumpy old horse lady that gives riding lessons and yells at everybody. You know, like my wife, when she was young, had a had a riding instructor, and there was an old school bus parked in the arena. I don't know why. And this lady just yelled and screamed. And every time she went, Robin went around the ring and she went behind that school bus, she would cry because she couldn't cry in front of the instructor. And it's like, you've got every right to be that, but you are not. You are, what I want to know is, where did the woo come from? You know, you talk about heart math and all that stuff. I mean, that's the stuff that excites me. And, you know, a lot of times people have had, like, say, a near-death experience or something like that to make them think differently. And you said a minute ago, yeah, where did I start to think differently? And I kind of sat up in the chair like, yes, I want to know where you start to think differently. Because really what I want to share with people on the podcast is that there is a different way to think, and all that stuff on the quantum field is available to everybody when you can start to think differently. But a lot of times I think we are lucky, those that are on that path, we're lucky because something happens to us and all of a sudden you start to think differently, whether it's a near-death experience or, you know, all sorts of things. So that I mean, you sounded like from a very young age, you were very intuitive with the horses anyway. You know, you, instead of thinking, I want this horse to do what I want in this show ring, you were like, what fun can we have together? But did it just really come naturally to you, or was there a something that happened that sent you on that bit of a path, that quite the big path that you're on?
What happened to me is I was born into my parents because my whole family, you know, my mother wouldn't kill a mouse. we're on a farm. We had mice. She would just take them and put them outside. And my grandfather would, you know, just say, if you get angry at a horse, get off, put it away, and cool off, or sit under a tree, because punishing doesn't work. It's not what you want to do. And one of the things that I think really, really affected my life is my mother, when I was also, I think, 8 or 9, bought this little thing, you know, a crocheted thing that went on the wall that said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And my parents, they lived that, which I'm just so blessed to be like that. It was always about kindness, and we didn't have any prejudice. We were, as a matter of fact, it was like, honor everybody. And that came from my mom and dad, and it was the start. And then I would say the big shift, which came first, 67 or 72. Okay. One of the big things that has been a cornerstone of my life, my adult life, was in 1967, I saw an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle, and it said, for $5, you can buy the first computer-generated astrological chart about your future. So I sent away for my 30th birthday, and I still have it. It's this little mimeographed, really nice little book with a little ribbon coming together. 98 mimeographed page, full, you know, 8.5 by 11 pages. But when I opened it, what got me was the fact that it said, in my lifetime, I would develop a form of communication that would spread around the world. And in order to do so, I would have to learn to trust my intuition. And that's where that came from, you know, that. So I went to our library, and because my husband was a scholar, we had a really big library, and I just reached up and I pulled down a book, and it was a Rosicrucian book. And I looked up the definition of intuition, and that's where it said unlearned knowledge. And of course, today, I mean, we know it's in the quantum field. You just have to learn to listen. And if you want to learn to listen, I mean, Greg Braden's, one of his first books, The Matrix. Have you read that?
Yeah, yes.
It's really an important book to read. It's like, I was so excited when I read that. And so I just started listening at that point. And the big shift that came then, the big next big shift was in 72. And I went to Esalen Institute down on the Big Sur
coast,
and
really?
I had a friend there who invited me down.
Wow.
And it just happened to be an invitation. It was an invitational weekend with Robert Monroe, who has the Monroe Institute on the East Coast. It was before he'd even started the Institute, I'm quite sure. And we were doing this out of the body stuff with Robert Monroe. And also Russell Tark, Dr. Russell Tark from Stanford, head of Stanford Research, was there. And he was working with each person. There were 40 of us in that weekend. And what he said, he was wanting to know the amount of logic and intuition parts of the brain that were mostly used by the people in that weekend. And so he told me that I had, you know, one of the closest to a 50-50 use of both logic and intuition. And I always thought I didn't have any logic, right? So I started studying about it, and I read Betty Edwards' something from the right side of the brain. And I started doing these exercises, these really lovely just movements in this infinity sign, and, you know, in the air, writing your name backwards with the, you know, one hand and forwards with the other. And I did it a lot. And the whole time I was really, at that point, we had closed our school and Rent and I had split. And I had the amazing fortune, who has been instrumental in your life, to be taken under the wing of Countess Margaret Bessenyei, a Hungarian countess. And she had like 12 horses, Hungarian horses, with us in training. And every morning, she, as an owner, she would call me and we'd spend an hour on the phone talking about the horses. This is before I started the school that day. And so I started really paying attention to observing. And I mean, it was way before I knew about heart math, but it was like coming from the heart. How can we? And I was reading at the time, like many of these books that teach you to think before you open your mouth, you know, because the words we speak have energy. And you don't want to put something out there that you'd be sorry for. They're really hard to take back often. So I was reading that kind of stuff, which is, of course, life-changing. And I want to share some of the important moments, because all of those different books. So anyway, 1960, big deal. My grandfather, Will Kaywood, visited us at the research, at the Thoroughbred farm, because I had never met him. I mean, that's a whole other story. He was I thought his brother, George, who was actually my great uncle, I thought George was my grandfather, because Will had been at the racetrack. As a matter of fact, it is interesting, because actually it was a huge influence on me. I only knew about him because he was an American jockey who was taken to Russia by an Austrian racehorse owner. And I actually have his visa to Russia and the contract from his agent. And he went and picked met these horses in Europe, took them by boxcar to Moscow, and raced in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And he liked it so much in Russia that he decided to stay on and became a trainer. And in 1905, he won the really, you know, wonderful recognition from the Tsar Nicholas II of being the leading trainer at the Moscow racetrack that year with 87 winners. And you can say, oh, well, it's a story. Well, I went 10 times to Russia as a citizen diplomat with Esalen Institute, just wanting to make connections people to people. And I went in a horse museum in Moscow with my friend who was translating for me. And that I told this, like he had to be 90 years old, one person in this little horse museum. And when he heard about my grandfather, he went down in the basement and brought out a newspaper article about my grandfather. And I still, of course, have that article translated. So my grandfather, Will, then came to our thoroughbred farm when he retired at 80. He came to our thoroughbred farm and he showed us some of these secrets, because, you know, in the horse world, everybody has their secrets. And he said that the reason that he was that successful, he had 87 winners, like first, second, or third, in that season. And he said there were two reasons for it. One, he never put a horse in a race unless it told him it was feeling fit enough to really run well. And the other thing he said, that every horse in his stable was rubbed with these short little strokes over the whole body by the grooms. Because in those days, you know, grooms were there all the time. Like his grooms, one groom had three horses. And so we started using this massage for our sport horses. And that was the book that based on the some of the book that of the endurance that we, you know, all the endurance stuff that we did, which you read about. So we don't have to go there. The other part's much more fun, really. So I want to get back to this track of what really changed me. Well, first of all, what was important, we were using that form of massage on our endurance horses, our 100-mile horses, and also on our show horses, because, and we found that they could recover much faster when you know, had their body feeling well. But never crossed my mind that you could actually change the behavior of a horse by working on the body. And so 15 years, we did this successfully with this form of massage from my grandfather. And as far as we can tell, it was the first book in English on massage for horses. And in 1975, I enrolled at the Humanistic Psychology Institute in San Francisco with a four-year course with Dr. Moshe Feldenkrais. Have you ever heard of the Feldenkrais method?
Yes, and my introduction to that was a video on. So there's a magazine called Eclectic Horseman, and they also put out some videos. And your sister, I believe, Robin Hood is your sister, isn't she? Yeah. She. There was a thing on Feldenkrais on there. That was the first time I'd ever heard of it. And then I actually met your sister at a horse expo in New Zealand a couple of years ago. But before I talk to you here, I thought I need to know more about this Feldenkrais method, and I looked it up. What a fascinating life that guy had. Like, such an eclectic, array of experiences he had. And he said when he fled the Nazis, he took a jar of heavy water with him. So I had to look up what heavy water was. And yeah.
I never heard of it.
Oh, you haven't? It's water that's got one molecule change, and it's got some, and it can be a toxin. Fascinating stuff. But when he fled the Nazis, he carried a jar of heavy water and something else. And it was some sort of a document, but yeah, sorry to interrupt, but yes, I have heard of the Feldenkrais method, what was your introduction to that?
So my introduction was at Esalen Institute in 1973, and I just went down for a weekend. And one of the lessons from the Feldenkrais method, we were led through. And, you know, riders, you, as a rule, before centered riding or connected riding, you sat in one position depending upon what discipline you're riding. And we were a stiff bunch. I mean, you know, my husband's way to get your shoulders back was to stick a stick through your elbows.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's quite, you know, it's typical. And so I'm telling you, Warwick, after 1 hour, I got up and I could move my body like I had never imagined. And I always say, you know, that night at Esalen, they had a rock and roll dance. And I mean, I danced my ass off. That's what I felt like. It was so much fun. So 2 years later, I had then shut down my school, and moved to Germany, thinking I needed to go around the world and find out what I was really meant to be here about. Because I was really, you know, disturbed about the horse world. It was just not the way I wanted to be with horses. And so I had met Peter Caddy, who was the co-founder of Findhorn. Do you know of Findhorn?
No.
Yeah, you got to look it up.
How do you spell that?
F-I-N-D, like find, horn, yep. H-O-N, one word, Findhorn, in Northern Scotland.
Okay, I've got to look that up for you. So if you guys listening, Linda keeps talking about Esalen. And so I've heard about Esalen before quite a bit in like a lot of the books that I've read and things like that. And I think so a couple of years ago, probably 4 years, 5 years ago now, I went to, my wife and son and I all went to what is it called now? Esalen's what started a landmark forum. Do you know what Landmark is?
Oh, it changed my life in one weekend.
Oh, you went to Landmark. Yeah, so I think Landmark actually came out of what started it at Esalen. But I'm going to read, for the you guys listening, I'm going to read this thing off Esalen's website. It says, Esalen is a non-for-profit holistic education center offering wild comfort and space for emergent transformation and internal exploration that has been in operation since 1962. Anchored by the inspiring beauty of Big Sur and an incomparable intellectual history, we are always negotiating nuance, tangled with complexity, and sitting inside contradiction. All the while, we embrace the messy, imperfect practice of moving towards our highest humanity. Boom.
Yeah. Yes, boom. It's truly amazing, and I hope they recover after COVID. It's an issue. But anyway, if you ever have anybody listening, if you ever have a chance to go there, it's amazing. So I had been there several times teaching what I was doing at the time, the Feldenkrais work after I graduated. And then when I switched to the circular T-touch, of course, I continued to go there. And it is life-changing, but now I have to go back. How did I jump onto it? I shut down my school and I had moved to Germany because of another woman, like one of these totally life-changing experiences, Ursula Bruns, who was she's crossed the Rainbow Bridge quite a few years ago, sadly, but she had written sold well over a million books, and her videos that she did were really, now they're a film and they're very famous. Anyway, she read about us in Western Horsemen, because at one point we had a syndicated column in 8 horse magazines in the 60s. Yes, in the 60s. And then she read about us. So she wrote to us and wanted to visit. So she visited our school and she saw our students like riding and jumping with no bridles. And she wanted to know how we were doing that. It was really simple. And so then I showed her all over California, and she'd never seen things like, you know, they had no possibility of having a stall with a paddock. It just didn't exist then. And she started all of that. And she was an incredible innovator in the horse world. Certainly changed my life. And so then she invited me back to Germany. And I spent at least a month going all around Germany with her, visiting many types of horses. And so I had met with Peter Caddy over breakfast, because he had been told by Jenny O'Connor, who was channeling the Nine. Did you ever hear of the Nine?
No.
The Nine, they were extraterrestrials from the star Sirius come to help in the evolution of mankind. it's kind of like, do you know Abraham and Esther Hicks?
Yes, yes.
It's like Abraham. It's not Abraham. It's not one entity. It's a, you know, literally beings who are interested in helping us. And Peter Caddy had been in Hawaii visiting with Jenny O'Connor, who channeled the Nine, and the Nine told him he was supposed to contact me when he came to Carmel, where I was living at the time. And so I met him, we went to breakfast, and then I just became totally affected by just like one experience of being with him. He was going to meet a guy in Carmel Valley to see if he could support him in some way, because he had developed a form of like wind-driven energy, but not like anything that we have now. And it was these amazing, the drawings were absolutely incredible. And I just lay on the floor while this Peter was visiting with this guy, listening to him. And I'm telling you, Warwick, I was out there, long way out in the universe. And when we finished that meeting, I went home and I thought, I'm not supposed to be doing this horse thing anymore. I have to find out what I'm really here to do on the planet. So I shut down my stable, sold like 60 horses, and went to Europe. I went hunting in Ireland first, just for fun. And then I spent time with Ursula Bruins, and she said, oh, and I was actually on my way to spend time in Zambia, Zaire, actually, with a friend who had been in my first grade class when she was 6 years old. And she was filming gorillas. And I was going to go and spend time with her in the bush. But it was raining at the time. It's this rainy season at that time. So I stayed with Ursula Bruins. And then she said, listen, Linda, why don't you just stay here? And I want you to head a school and the type of riding that I was doing here. And she had an amazing connections, you know, with the government. And so I said, okay, I'll stay for 1 year in the horse world and then I'm out of here. It's not what I'm supposed to be doing. So I stayed that 1 year. And my partner at the time, who's still one of my really good friends, Roger Russell, he wasn't a horse person, but he wanted to learn the Feldenkrais method because we'd been together at Esalen and had that amazing experience, you know, with moving in a different way. And so he rode away and found out that Moshe Feldenkrais was teaching for the first time a professional training in San Francisco. So he rode away to sign up for it and got the brochure and Warwick. I just had that brochure in my hand and I said, I'm supposed to do that. There's not a question. and so I signed up for it and I did it thinking that it would be good for my riding students. Because, you know, I mean, horsewomen were always getting hurt or banged up or whatever. I had no idea it would change my life. And so in the very first week of the class, we were 63 people. We were lying on this in this beautiful old building in San Francisco, old university, and we were being led through what's called an awareness or movement. And Moshe said, talked about the possibility through these gentle, non-habitual movements, which is part of the Feldenkrais method, that it's possible to develop new neural pathways to the brain to activate new brain cells so we could have more potential for learning. And I can remember like lying there on the floor and so like my ears pricked up like a horse. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. If that's true for a horse, for a human, what could we do for a horse that would cause that horse to move in a gentle, non-threatened, non-habitual way that would give them a new potential for learning without force and, you know, without pushing. And so that very afternoon, I went out to visit a friend of mine that had just brought an Arab mare down from Montana, where she'd been a broodmare all her life. She was 16, never been ridden. And I was looking for problem horses. So this horse had to be chased after and caught up every day to come into the stable to be fed. I mean, not logical, right? So he ran around, you know, caught her, brought her up. And so I just started like thinking, okay. And remember, we've been doing massage for 15 years on horses. So I just started moving the legs and whatever part of the body I could move in a gentle way without the horse resisting, that would give her new activation of new neural pathways. I'm just exploring. I have no idea what I'm doing. Just how can I move this horse, the tail and the head and the ears and the legs, which we've been doing for years already on the legs, but never with the concept of doing it in a way that the horse would get a new, you know, new activate new neural pathways. So I maybe did this for 30 minutes, and there were quite a few of his friends who were gathered watching me, and they thought I'd hypnotized this horse. She was so quiet. So, you know, I go away. Next morning, he calls me. He said, I don't know what you did to my horse, but I turned her out after you were here. When I went to catch her, instead of having to chase her, she was at the gate. And when I let her into the stall, instead of diving for the hay, she goes like, do some more of that stuff. And it completely changed her. And so that's when I just started, wait a minute, you know, instead of lunging horses forever and running them around the round pen, because I did all of that, how can I move this horse in a way that will be, that she can do, or he can do possibly? So I started playing all summer. And anyway, that just was the beginning of the exploration of a different way of being with horses. And I'm trying to think of like some other people. So my life would not be what it is. And I could definitely not be moving like this if I hadn't done that 4 years with Moshe Feldenkrais. And so in the second year of the training, we were given a book to read called Man on His Nature by Sir Charles Sherrington. And Sherrington had won a Nobel Prize for the study of photons with the cells. And in the second chapter of his book, Rupert, I'm sitting in Stuttgart in Mövenpick restaurant on a cold February day reading this book. And in the second chapter on body wisdom, he writes in this like really intrigued way. I mean, just think of the wonder that this is. If you get a little cut on your hand, think of all that it takes for the body to rally to heal that. And his concept is that every cell in the body knows its function in the body. And I mean, this is what at the end I want to leave you with, because I've taken it to a whole other level through many years. But I want to, in the UK, they call, you know, getting a vaccination was jabbing. I want to jab everybody with the wonder that we are with logic behind it. So I remember sitting back and looking at my hands like this and saying, wait a minute, when I don't yet know how to do the miracles that I saw Moshe do. And by that, I mean, like in 30 minutes, he took a 28-year-old woman that first year who'd had a stroke the year before and was very inhibited in her movement. And through these gentle movements, which I didn't yet know how to do, but we can all do it, who've gone through that work. And so she was able to walk out a different person and shake hands. And I thought, okay, wait a minute. Now, I don't yet know how to do this, but all I have to do is just say, self here, just, I want the intelligence of these cells to connect with this, whether it's a human or an animal, and just be, this is before the touches, just be able to communicate and remind that body of its phenomenal potential for ideal function. at the cellular level. Now, when I started talking about cells in it, I started seeing the body as a collection of cells. When I started talking about this, okay, Linda's lost it, right? What's she talking about? Now, of course, you just go on Google and look up cellular wisdom, and it's everywhere. It's really a game changer when we start to recognize that. So I started looking at the body through my whole training as this collection of amazing intelligence. And I was really successful, Roger and I both, with working with humans, which is what he did, and with horses in moving them in non-habitual ways. Didn't matter what their discipline. And I was doing a lot of stuff in Europe with that and teaching. And so in 1983, I had another. Oh, and by the way, I want to say, I want to honor Roger Russell because, you know, as you say, who are the people who just made a difference in your life? And he was one of these genius guys. When I met him at Esalen in 73, he looked like kind of like a Moroccan hash dealer. Wild hair and jeans that would stand up on their own, you know, in the corner. And we did one of these exchanges where you interview somebody and, you know, our question was like, can you be close to God and have sex? So it was thanks to him that we actually even studied the Feldenkrais work in the first place. So, you know, I want to put that mark on the wall because I think it's really important to honor the people who have moved us, you know, who we are, thanks to those people. So where do I want to excite you about the next? So,
Worry, you're exciting me. I'm like, I'm sitting here just bouncing up and down. So you're exciting me, don't worry.
So we did this work with humans and animals and horses in Europe. And then I came back in 80 and Roger and I split because I went in partnership with a really big ranch deal with one of my students and he didn't want to manage that. He wanted to stay on and be and really delve into the Feldenkrais work, which he's now done. And he's one of the trainers. So anyway, I'm doing a big weekend workshop at the Delaware Equine Veterinary Center and with Dr. Matthew McKay Smith. Did you ever meet him?
Mm-mm.
Being a horse, he was one of the vet editors for Equus magazine for many years and a horseman from the day he was born. The whole family was into it. He's a really wonderful horseman. So it was his clinic. And Dr. Danny Marks, who was the vet for the American jumping team, and they were good friends of mine. So they asked me to do a workshop at their place. And one of them actually, Alan Leslie, one of the other vets for the three-day team for the U.S., they had a horse that they couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. She was 12 years old, a thoroughbred mare. And man, when you would approach her with a grooming bucket, she started to, you know, threaten you with her teeth and if you move around and threaten to kick. And in those days, I don't think you're old enough to remember this, but in the 80s, all the vets did was, and these are the team, U.S. Olympic team, really good horsemen. All they did was x-ray from the knees and hocks down. There's no osteopathy, not even acupuncture was hardly any vets were using it. So they couldn't figure out why was this mare so reactive on the body. And they asked me to look at her from the Feldenkrais point of view. So I just put my hands really quietly on her. And of course, now you are well aware of the heart math concept that if you put your heart field out there, if you come from your heart and not just your head, what am I going to do? Animals feel it. And so she was really quiet. And I just quietly put my hands on her. And she stood there quietly. And her owner said, okay, Linda, come on. What is your secret? So why is your horse so quiet for you? And I said, intuitively. Don't worry what I'm doing. Just walk up and quietly put your hands on the shoulder and move the skin in a circle. I didn't say a circle and a quarter. That came later. And she did. And I didn't tell her, I didn't know what I was talking about. Like, what is that about? But I trust. A long time I'd already trusted my intuition on that. And so when I saw her do that, I thought, wow, you know, it takes years to learn this beautiful Feldenkrais stuff. Anybody can move the skin in a circle. And what can we do to affect behavior and release the fear? And so I started following the path of circles. And in 1981, I had been teaching a week long, every week, the Course in Miracles. Do you know of the Course in Miracles? You must.
You know, I know of it. I haven't had much to do with it. I follow a lot of different people, but Gabby Bernstein talks about A Course in Miracles quite a bit. And there was a quote I read one time, that I think it comes from A Course in Miracles, and it said something like, I've got it in my phone here. I've got to read this to you. It's a quote about patience, I think, but it's something like those who believe can wait and wait without, of course, miracles. Okay. Those who are certain of the outcome can afford to wait and wait without anxiety.
Interesting. I don't
know. That's what I've got written in my phone from A Course in Miracles. That's what I heard somewhere. So I don't know much about it though.
It sounds so. Anyway, I'm going to talk about it because you can study it online with some of the top teachers in the world. I was out in the boondocks near, you know, we had a ranch at that point near Atascadero, California.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was a learning center. And of course, people came to us for seven, many weeks at a time to study. And so there was no one else in the area to teach it. So I just got the book and I was in consultation with one of my friends like every month about, you know, what does this mean? Because I hadn't learned it yet before. I was learning as I was going. There's one big workbook and you read a part of it once a week, and then there are lessons and you do one lesson every day. And the lessons are like really the basis of quantum science. Because it's like, this table is not real. What do they mean by that? Well, it's not really solid. You know, when you understand now the whole thing of quantum science, it means that we can do absolute miracles. So what changed my life in that book was one sentence. And that is, the aggression comes from a place of fear and as a cry for help. And Warwick, when I read that, I thought of several horses that I used to call it, you know, I gave them thunder, like one real whack. If a horse had bucked or bitten or done something, kicked, whack, one whack. And I thought, wait a second. If that truly comes from a fear, from a place of fear, what can I do to override that fear? And one of the things that's important here is to realize that in our work, understanding behavior does not excuse it. But instead of punishing for it, through the Tellington method, we have all these different ways of working on the ground with different equipment and the work on the body that takes away the fear in horses. And
well, there's another side to that too, though. Is yeah. The punishment comes from a place of fear from the human as well.
Exactly. It's exactly the same. And so, you know, a lot of people ask me, well, what do you think about this kind of method where they're doing all this stuff that I'd rather they not do? I hold the infinite possibility now from quantum science and forgiveness, that person will start to see the horse in a different way. Because if I say, well, that's really a terrible thing, come on, we've all done stuff that
we've all been there. Yeah.
Well, we've all been there. And so that's where Ho'oponopono really comes in. And I don't normally tell this on public things. It's time I did, because in 1981, I had another experience that really changed my life. And that's what you want, right? Life-changing people? Okay.
Yeah.
So I am doing a process called clearing the earth dust from your body. And I'm getting, there wasn't much more said about it except that, but I was just standing there with my eyes closed and this process was being done. And when I finished standing there through closed eyes, Jesus stood in front of me and said, you're ready to do my work. And I think, you know, what you'd usually think, well, who am I, blah, blah. And then I said, what can I do? And he just said, teach forgiveness. Well, I can do that. And that's where Ho'opono came in years ago. And I just moved from Hawaii after 24 years of living there, of headquartering there. We were teaching around the world, but that was our headquarters. And that's the source of Ho'oponopono. And it is so life-changing. Have you ever been exposed to Ho'oponopono?
No, well, maybe I haven't, didn't know what it was, but
Hawaii? Let me tell you something first. You want to interview one of these guys now who teaches it. And he has these free, like every week he has a free thing. And his name is Ulrich Dupre, Dupree. And there are many books on Ho'oponopono. But
how do you spell that? Because I'm going to be looking this up.
Right. H-O-apostrophe.
H-O.
Yeah, apostrophe. P-O-N-O. Wait, ho. Oh, no, sorry. H-O-apostrophe. O-P-O-N-O. P-O-N-O. Ho-O-pono-pono.
Ho-O-pono-pono. Okay.
And the thing, you will really enjoy this man. I had never met him, but I just got a picture yesterday from one of my friends who did a workshop with him last month, and she told him that it was one of my books that made her look him up. So he wanted to take a picture together and send it to me. So I just, you would really enjoy this guy.
Wow. Eric. Where in Hawaii did you live? Were you?
In Kona, Kailua Kona.
Okay. My son lives in Hawaii, that's all.
Where? Well, we're on the Big Island. That's what we have to say.
Okay, you're on the Big Island. Yeah, no, he lives in Oahu.
Yep. It was a great place to be when I was on the road traveling. It's a great, great place to vacation, but I want more action. That's why we moved to Florida.
So you live in Florida now?
We bought a house that we haven't seen because we closed our house, sold it in Florida and in Hawaii, moved, then flew to Florida. Stayed 2 weeks house hunting. And we didn't manage to get one because the prices are crazy there too. And we got on a ship and a friend of ours said, our realtor showed us this house and we bought it. So we're so excited. It's like 2 acres of grass. So I can bring a horse over and let him graze a couple hours a day. And we have a heated salt water swimming pool. And the whole thing is like hurricane proof because that's what my husband just insisted on. So we're excited.
Hurricane
proof. And we really care about it. Hurricane means it can't be blown down.
Right. So where we live in Hollister, California. So we're only 45 minutes from Santa Cruz or Monterey. So you're very familiar with the area. Yep. And, we're in the bottom end of Silicon Valley. So it's very expensive here. And we'd like to have, we've only got 6 acres and we'd like to have a bigger place just to have bigger pastures for the horses and stuff. But the trouble is it's very, very hard to find a place in America that doesn't have fires, tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever. Cause that's my wife's big thing. Like she doesn't want them she doesn't mind the earthquakes here because they come once every 100 years sort of thing. But Yeah, hurricane proof. That would be high on her list.
So, well, my husband too, because oh my God, floods and hurricanes, the whole thing could be underwater, right? So, what it means is that the house is built of, you know, cement block, mm-hmm. and then stucco on the other. And the windows, the ideal situation is you have hurricane proof, shatter proof windows. Otherwise, you have just these light metal things you put up over them for hurricane. But he wanted it all, and we finally found it. But in the houses that we were, I mean, so many of the houses were built in the 80s there, and they're still standing. That's my attitude is, if your house blows down, take the insurance and build it again. You know, but that's not everybody's way of thinking, We're really excited about it, and we downsized. It's almost half the size of our house in Hawaii. I mean, it was ridiculous for two people, but we did our big workshops there. You know, we did several workshops a year, and we could have like 24 people in our downstairs living room. So anyway, look at Florida.
Look at Florida. Okay, so let's go back to Ho'oponopono thing. Tell me more about that. I mean, because it sounds, or I'll tell you what, to me, it sounds like, well, let's get back to Rupert Isaacson. You know, that's how we connected. I had Rupert on the podcast, and I think Rupert thought I wanted to talk about horse boy stuff and all that sort of thing, because it's a horse podcast. And, but what really interests me is in indigenous wisdom. You know, old wisdom, ancient wisdom. And, you know, I'm sure this is an ancient kind of Hawaiian connection to something greater than us, you know. So, yeah, tell me more about this stuff. It excites me.
So the reason it has spread, like, it's over in 50 languages around the world. And the reason is it's so simple. It's based on four separate phrases. Please forgive me for anything. I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm sorry. Thank you for the forgiveness. And I love you. Now, the I love you just really stops so many people. And I didn't understand it until I spoke to one of my friends who reads French and read the book. It's the Book of Ho'oponopono, and you would really enjoy that book because it explains the way it works based on the connection to heart math and to quantum science, and it's wonderful. And where I got what I needed to understand, to explain to people what that means, I love you, because if I love yourself or do I love the other person, that's where it all mixes together really beautifully with A Course in Miracles, this concept that I am you, that we are so one at the cellular level. And so anyway, what that means, like when people who can't say, I bet you know a lot of people like I do, they can't say I love you to themselves.
Right.
But you know what made me have the understanding of it? Love the divine spark in yourself. Because now that's where I want to give some credit to the next person that made me come to another level, and that is Bruce Lipton.
His
The Spontaneous Evolution. Have you read that? Have you looked at that book? It took me like 2 months to read it because it's so rich, but there's one chapter. And now you listening, go to YouTube and listen to Bruce Lipton.
So the only one of Bruce Lipton's I've got is The Biology of Belief. So what's the name of this one?
It's called Spontaneous Evolution.
Spontaneous Evolution. Okay.
It's co-authored, and his premise is this. He talks about the evolution of the cells and how it's so incredible that every cell is in communication with the other parts of the body. Now, come on, Warwick, think about it. How come our blood flows and we don't have to do anything about it. How come we can see? Why can we speak? Because every cell in the body knows its function in the body. That was the first introduction for me from Sherrington. But 2 years ago, I started sharing in my, I have a online weekly two hours of Tea Touch for self-help, self-care. And we read a book called Cellular Wisdom by Joan L. King. And she was for 20 years, she taught cell biology at Tufts University of Medicine. And one day she read a legend that changed her life. And she left the field of the university and started teaching cellular wisdom as a way of understanding ourselves. And that's what Bruce Lipton talks about in Spontaneous Evolution. Listen, if we could just cooperate like our cells do in our body with this intelligence, then our world would be different. And I personally think that's what's happening now with all this terrible stuff that's happening in the Ukraine. People are beginning to be more compassionate and really caring. And I don't know what moved us from that, because look what's happening in Africa. There's so many people starving, but not much people pay attention. But something has happened in this planet, and I believe it's time that it could really make a huge change for us to begin to care about what other people are feeling and thinking. Yep.
Yeah, I think there's a huge change coming. And like the change that I see is like in the horse world, as far as the stuff that I'm talking about and you're talking about, wasn't really talked about not all that long ago, you know what I mean? And just these days, I think with the advent of the internet, there's no reason to be, I don't want to say the word ignorant, but uninformed anymore. And like you're talking about Bruce Lipton and guys like that, and you, I'm not sure if it's in one of his books, but you know, like when you hear stories about like people that have like say a heart transplant or something or other, and the new person takes on the either the personality or the quirks or the even food preferences. I remember reading about someone had a heart transplant, and the person that received the heart was, you know, was in his maybe in his 50s, in his 50s, and he had like a very advanced palate and like certain sorts of foods. And then he started craving like hamburgers and French fries and stuff like that he's never ever wanted. And then he finds out that the heart he got was from this 18-year-old who loved hamburgers and French fries. Or suddenly they want to play the guitar. They've never been musical before. And the person that had the previous heart, you know, like the, and also like with Bruce Lipton talking about how every cell's the same, and it's not till you give that gene the expression that it decides whether it becomes a lung or a heart or a leg or an eye or an ear or a toe or whatever. You know, it's just so fascinating to, and these days it's, I think the science backs up the, that's the thing I'm really finding, is science backing up ancient wisdom, science backing up spiritual practices that we just, before you needed to believe, and now you kind of have the proof. And I think that the people who are quite left-brained, it really helps them maybe be open to like spiritual things or whatever, because now I can understand, I can, instead of having the intuition level, you have the, you know, the quantitative, the, you know, I understand it, I can quantify it. So now I'm into it. Yeah, it's an exciting, I think it's a really exciting time.
It's very exciting. And in this book, the Cellular Wisdom by Joan C. King, her first sentence is every cell is a genius. And then she starts to explain in a totally scientific way exactly the function of each cell. I mean, it's so intriguing and really exciting. And what I've been doing, I've been teaching on Zoom for the last 3 years, actually. And what we found for years is we can, with these 1 1/4 basic circles, we can reduce or disappear pain yourself. Doesn't take someone else, but with these basic 1 1/4 circles, or reduce or just disappear fear, you know, with these heart hugs that we do and this really understanding that we can measurably shift the focus that you have in an emotional situation from the limbic system to the forebrain, and from the control of the sympathetic nervous system, fight, flight, freeze, faint, fool around, to the parasympathetic, the ability to connect from the heart and the head, as the beautiful research, that amazing research that HeartMath Institute continues to do. So it's like, it's no longer a woo-woo thing. It's science. And that's what's so exciting.
You know, I had a guest on the podcast from Scotland, and there's a saying that she said during that podcast that people talk about all the time. She said, you can't fight the woo.
Well, you can by ignoring it, but she must have come from Findhorn, and that's the Findhorn stuff.
It's amazing.
They're really, you got to look it up and see the origins of it, because they basically at Findhorn, they took this piece of property, which is like not good soil, terrible weather, and they have created these amazing gardens that were studied from people around the world. And they did it by actually by cooperating with nature spirits. And it's you have to see it. I mean, you have to get to know them.
So they grew stuff in non-fertile ground by
working with the nature spirits and the soil. And
so this comes back to like indigenous practices. I mean, indigenous people have done this sort of stuff for
right
millenniums, you know what I mean?
Yep. Yes. And one of the books that I think you would really enjoy of Greg Braden, it's The Spontaneous Healing of Belief. And one, like I always get one concept out of every book that I read of his. I mean, they're amazing, all of them. But it's this concept of energy. You see, when I did the Feldenkrais training, Moshe Feldenkrais would never allow us to speak about energy. And I did that training in the 70s, and everybody was talking about energy at the time, of course, you know. But we weren't allowed, because he was a scientist with a PhD from the Sorbonne. And that means you couldn't define energy. But interesting definition of Greg Braden is that every thought we have is energy. And you can prove that. If you have you read, one of the books that I feel is really important is The Field by Lynn McTaggart. And she, Intention Experiment, tells of all of these studies from many, many universities around the world that show that how we can affect our computers by our thoughts, just you can send your thoughts and affect measurably somebody across the room or across the world. And so anyway, so every thought is energy. Every feeling we have is energy. Every emotion is energy, and every belief. So our beliefs can either, limit us or open us to infinite possibilities. That's what
infinite possibilities. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I said something about, different things that have happened to me in the last 10 or 12 years or more that you would call me lucky. You know what I mean? And I said to him, you know what? It's funny is I didn't used to be lucky. And then when something changed where I started to view things differently. And when I started to look at the world differently, I'm a big believer in the saying, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And And yeah, at some point in time, I got really, really lucky, but I didn't used to be lucky. So yeah, you know, you were just talking about thoughts and, you know, thoughts and emotions and all that stuff for energy. And there's a really, really good, have you ever read Becoming Supernatural by Dr. Joe Dispenza?
No, but I don't even know that name.
Oh, so Dr. Joe was the guy that I went to in London when I did the Craig Braden thing. He did him Dispenza. And Craig Braden. Dispenza.
Do you mean? Oh, yeah. No, of course I know him. But I don't know what.
So that book's called Becoming Supernatural. But in there, he talks about an experiment done by a French guy, and his last name's Epoch, E-P-O-C-H. But what he does is he has you know what one of them robot vacuums are like, the robot vacuum that goes around? Well, it changes direction when it bumps into something, doesn't it? Okay. Well, they made this robot that was a random generated directional change. So it would go, then it would turn, and it would turn, but it was all random. It was randomly generated by the computer, just like you can have a random number generator or whatever. And you put it in this area, and they mapped where it used, you know, what, how much of the area it used. And this screen you're looking at here, with this random generating robot, it basically used the whole area. If you mapped it over a period of time, it kind of used the whole area. Then what they, this is crazy. Then what they did was they imprinted some baby chickens onto the robot. You know, you can imprint a baby chicken onto whatever. And so these baby chickens looked at this robot like its mother. And so they followed it around wherever it went. And once again, it still used basically the whole area. Then after they got the baby chickens imprinted on there, they took the baby chickens out of the area and they put them in a little enclosure off to the side of that area. So what do you think these baby chickens' thoughts are now saying? They're away from their mother. They're like, mommy, mommy, come over here, mommy. So then the random directional changing robot, when they let it go again, it basically only used the half of the area on the side of the chickens. So, and I talk about this, I do a lot of clinics all around the world, and I talk to people about this with their horses. If chickens can influence where a robot goes by their thoughts, then the thoughts you have about your horse have way more influence than that. And especially if you view, you know, if you view your horse's behavior as bad or whatever you label that behavior, if you have this negative attitude towards your horse's behavior, instead of thinking of your horse's behavior as an unmet need or a, you know, it's how they feel at the moment. It's not good or bad or right or wrong. It's how they feel at the moment. If you can change that, then you're not adding to whatever's going on in a negative way. Do you know who Mark Rashid is?
Yes, of course.
So yes. I had Mark on the podcast, and he was talking about, you know, he's into Aikido, which is a type of martial art, and he talks about the thought in Aikido of having a mind like still water. And he says, you know, if you go out in the early morning when there's no breeze and you look at a pond, when you look at that pond, you get a direct reflection of what's on the other side of that pond. You get a direct reflection of that. But if you take a little pebble and throw it in the middle of that pond and there's ripples, you have now affected what that thing on the other side of the pond looks like. And he says, you know, it's kind of the same with your horse. If you come along to your horse and you don't have a mind like still water, your mind is judging and comparing and having expectations, all those sorts of things. You have now affected your horse, and it's going to be in a negative way. But that's not the horse's choice to behave that way. It's part of the energy or the intention that you're putting into the interaction.
Yeah, and it's a really important concept. And one of our basic keys to success of the Tellington Method is the concept that if you want to change your horse's behavior or performance or personality or relationship with you or even their well-being, you have to change your mind about what you're seeing. And yes, it's not that we ignore it, but we have the techniques to bring them to a place you would like them to have and focus on that. And it's so, I'm sure you must run into this all this time, like in Switzerland last week, I had a woman telling us about this behavior of their horse. And, you know, she'd gotten the horse from Poland and she was really dangerous and kicking and all that stuff. And I said, oh, interesting. Like, is she like that now? No. Well, when did that happen last? 4 years before. And that's, I get it all the time. People focus on something that happened a long time ago instead of thinking how lucky that horse is that she's now with these people who have a different attitude. And without holding that potential and then having the tools to get them to a place that you'd like, you can't change. It's really interesting. Yeah, these are important times, you know. There's another young person. I wonder if you've ever interviewed him. I just did some touch on him last week at Equitana, or last month, and I think he would be interesting for you to listen to. I mean, to interview.
And who is he?
Aguila. God. Arian Aguila.
And where is he from?
He might have been born in Mexico because that's where his dad was for a long time, but he lives right now in southern Germany.
And what does he do?
Well, I didn't watch his stuff, but everybody says he's wonderful with horses. He does performances with different types of liberty work.
Oh, but okay. I don't know the guy, but yes, I've seen that. I've seen that name. Yes.
Very nice young person and very respected horse person. And what got me is I just heard on my drive to the Munich airport to fly to Italy on Monday, I just heard that he was like 20 kilometers from where I was working for 4 days. And I'm so sorry that I didn't know that, because he's a young person worth knowing. And what really got me is he's working also with Liberty Work with pigs. And now I can't remember a second really interesting besides the horses. So he's, you know, he's kind of moving out of, because so many people do Liberty Work. And have you interviewed Frederic Pignon?
No, everybody says I got to get Frederic on there. Yeah, I've got to get him on here one day.
Yeah, because he's just a human being, a mensch, you know, like his brother too. I mean, yeah. And the thing that he does, that, I mean, I couldn't, I've co-taught clinics several times with him. And I was like blown out of the water when he starts talking about seeing your horse from a place of love.
Yes. And
this guy, really good. And I mean, you know, you've got two emotions, according to the Jerry Jampolsky, love and fear. What do we choose? Which one do we choose?
Yes, it's like the white wolf and the black wolf. Which one survives with whichever one you feed?
Interesting.
You know what I might do right now is, normally when I have guests on the podcast, I send them a list of 20 questions for them to choose. Questions.
Yeah.
And you know, I got to be totally honest here. I didn't send them to you because I thought, oh, she doesn't want to be bothered with that stuff. You know what I mean?
Hey, it's fun.
So I didn't send you the questions, but I'm going to pick a few of these. This will be interesting because you've probably already said it, but the first question is, what book do you recommend the most? Not necessarily your favorite book to read for you to read, but the one that you feel everybody else needs to read. What book would you recommend?
On what subject?
Hey, what book do you recommend the most? I mean, you can choose the subject. You have a book that you tell, like you've told me several books. Do you have a one, you got to read this book?
Right. And I have this huge, long book list. I have the book that I would say. And it's the year that I read it and the influence, your influenced me. But I would say, if you want something that has the potential for being life-changing, it's the book of Ho'oponopono by, it's such a toss-up between the spontaneous evolution of belief by
Bruce Lipton.
No, that's a hard book. You got to be really a serious.
You got to be a certain place to.
Yeah. But no, by Greg Braden, the spontaneous. Wait, what? Now I always get these two books between Bruce Lipton and Greg Braden mixed up. Google Greg Braden's books, the spontaneous evolution of belief. I think
we'll look it up and I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, do put it on because it's life changing. If you want to have something in a like a little book that has the potential for changing your life, it's that one by Ulrich Dupre, Dupree, just called Ho'oponopono.
Okay,
because it's something that will literally change your life. So what are the questions?
Okay,
love skeptical questions.
what was your biggest failure and how has it helped you?
Wow.
And see, normally I send these questions ahead of time and people pick ones that they have a thing for. And you can say pass if you like.
No, I don't need to pass. I want to think about it. And what I think about that is I don't see anything as a failure. Because whatever happened, it's an opportunity for me to learn something. So I can't, I mean, it's crazy things like, oh my God, you know, I gave up the chance to go to Hungary with my friend Margaret Bessonnier and learn foreign hand driving. I mean, these are, I'd love to think of something profound. That didn't happen or happened and I learned a lot from it, because that's my thing, is what can I learn, you know?
Oh, I can tell. So, I can tell. Well, let's go to the next one then, because you've probably touched on this a million times in this interview, but if you could spread a message across the world, one that people would listen to, what would that message be?
And I haven't been asked that question. I have the absolute answer. It's my latest learning. And that is, take time each day to count three blessings in your life and send it out around the planet.
So basically gratitude practice.
Yep.
Okay. So
gratitude. Because gratitude overrides fear. And that's been known since the 14th century. You can find reference to that.
Yeah, well, I think if you go back to more indigenous things, it's been around a whole lot longer than that.
Well, yeah, right. That's only, you know, the stuff that's been printed.
Right. Okay, so this one's interesting. What is an unusual habit you have or something out of the ordinary that you really love?
Seeing each person or each animal as a blessing, no matter what they look like. See the divine spark in each person and recognize whatever, if there's something about that person that, you know, I question, I know I have something about that in me. And that's straight from the Course in Miracles. You know, it's just a really important lesson, but it's seeing the beauty in people. You know, it's a wow factor for me of, I don't care what the person is or what the animal is. See the beauty.
That's not an unusual habit. I would like that to be everybody's habit. I think everybody should have the habit. But okay, what other questions can I ask you here? Okay, this one's, you've probably answered this already, but what do you feel is your true purpose in the world? And you've already.
No, I think it's like you have to really, how would you say that? I think my true purpose is to live gratitude. And yeah, and my specific purpose in the horse world, it's my next message for my next 20 years. And it's to open the infinite possibility that people will learn to see each of their horses as an individual. And just recognize the gifts that each horse brings to our life, no matter what it is, no matter how that horse is. Look for the gifts. But look for the, recognize that individual. Don't, you know, recognize the individual.
Yeah, you know, I really think that that's not just a horse thing, though, because what I found is helping people do that sort of thing with their horse. Look at their horse, you know, have the mind like still water about your horse. You can't just do it with your horse. It carries over. Once you start to do that sort of thing, it carries over to every part of your life. And I really, that's why this podcast is not really about horses. I mean, usually they're horse, sometimes, most times they're horse people on here, but what I find is that it always comes back to, you know, the reason someone is successful with horses is not because of a technique they have. It's who they are and how they view the world. And I think the great thing about horses for the general public is what I found is people will not change for their husband or for their wife or their kids or their boss or their coworker or whatever, but they will make some changes to get along with their horse better. And then that carries over into the rest of their life. So they influence, you know, that's an influence of everybody in their circle, everybody they come in contact with. And then if we can get those people to do the same thing with everyone they come in contact with. And I really think horses are a huge, one of the huge factors in changing the world, really.
Yeah, certainly the ones, and thanks to the possibility of things like your podcast or things like YouTube, people can be exposed to stuff they never had the opportunity in before.
Yeah, most certainly. Okay, what quality do you most admire in a person?
Kindness.
Good answer. But that just comes back to, you know, where does kindness in a person come from? It comes back to what everything you've been talking about so far, you know. That's very cool. What are the questions? There's 20 questions, and I usually have people, you know, pick 4 to 7 for me to weave into our conversation, and I don't think I've ever had anybody not choose this question, which gives you an idea of the type of people having the podcast. But the question is, what is your relationship like with fear?
I think fear is really important. It'll save your life, and being able to differentiate consciously and then have a way to deal with fear. And I have numerous ways to deal with fear that I recommend to people. But part of it is asking for help, prayer, if you're in a situation where you really need something. And recognizing that fear is real in the body for horse people, or people who deal with situations. Like I was just talking to one of our really incredible veterinarians. That's why I'm here this week in Italy giving a workshop at their place. And she had a really bad accident at one point. And there are times when she can catch herself and she can override it. But I'm sure you've seen it, Warwick, this concept that people who've had a really like a life-threatening accident, boy, they cannot get back on that horse, or they're always afraid when they're on that horse. When you recognize that, what we've discovered with these basic 1 1/4 circles and a pause and a circle back, gently moving the skin, that you can release fear at that cellular level. You can bring get back in the body, because if you've been really hurt or really afraid, because maybe a person who's not so experienced hasn't been really hurt, but really scared, it stays in the cells. And that's where, with these 1 1/4 circles, we can release fear at the cellular level. You can do it yourself. That's the good part.
You know, I didn't really want to get into technique and stuff like that in the podcast, but you've mentioned these 1 1/4 circles so much that tell me about these 1 1/4 circles.
Well, as I said, they came to me like intuitively at that one situation where the horse was so quiet for me, just because I had this quiet. I mean, talking about the stillness of the pond, what I learned how to be still was from my grandfather. When I remember when I was 9 years old, this like imagining I was an Indian, a Native American, like just sitting quietly, not just being. Isn't that funny at that age? And I'm sure it was from past life. But then I learned something from a little book called The Blind Samurai. And this blind samurai in the, 12th century or something, could never be bested by another swordsman, because he emptied his head like a gourd. And that means, of course, no, they didn't say that, but we know from the quantum field, he had all this help. And so that's what I've done for years. If I have a horse that won't go jump a ditch, yeah. And you haven't had any chance to train. You're just like at a big event. This is happened to me. It's in one of my books. And this stallion, Hungarian stallion, came out. You know how that is when a horse stops, especially a stallion. You can't push them forward. So the second he stopped, because that was his reputation that he would do this, it was a big ditch ahead of me practicing before a 3-day event. And as soon as he stopped, I just like got really still. Made it really clear, couldn't go left, couldn't go right, not an option to go back, but he wouldn't want to because I didn't push him. And I just held this possibility that he would choose to jump that ditch. And that's what he did. I don't know, I probably sat there, not asleep, man. It's not like you're, thinking of what you're going to eat for lunch. It's
right.
Like really clear, holding that possibility for that horse. And after a few minutes, he just started walking forward. I didn't push him, walked forward, trotted a few steps, jumped the ditch, and I never had a ditch problem with that horse in a 3-day event.
Okay. Let's go back to the quote that I thought was from A Course in Miracles. Okay. The quote said, "Those who are certain of the outcome can afford to wait and wait without anxiety." So how many people could be riding this Hungarian stallion? And the horse approaches the ditch and it stops.
And then they start.
And then they start doing everything. But you sat there and mentally you said, you can't go left, you can't go right, you can't go backwards. You didn't do it physically, but then you had the possibility of going forward. And you said you sat there for a couple of minutes. Now, a couple of minutes on a horse who doesn't want to do something and you sitting perfectly still is a lifetime for most people. But this comes back to that quote, those who are certain of the outcome can afford to wait and wait without anxiety. And a lot of the stuff I do these days with horses is wait.
Yep.
But you can't wait with anxiety. You can't wait with when is it going to happen? Why? You've got to have that certainty of that outcome. And you can, I love that quote. Those who are certain of the outcome can afford to wait and wait without anxiety.
Really beautiful. And the reason you and I can both be successful, because if it doesn't happen, I know I have another way to show that horse to overcome the fear that's been caused by the horse being beaten over a ditch.
Yep. I think there's so much to it, but one of the things that you are doing when you are sitting there, one of the things you're communicating to the horse is that I have no expectation. I'm not that other person. I'm not going to force you to do it. And I mean, there's so many infinitely small things that allow this stuff to happen. But one of them is showing that horse that you are different. That you I've been doing some stuff with horses for a number of years now, to where it's got a lot to do with not doing anything. And yep. They get, so you're not gonna, okay. And yeah, it's pretty crazy. let's not call it crazy, but yeah. Amazing stuff. So I was asking about the circle thing. Yeah. And you said you just intuitively did that. Like
the first thing was go up and put your hand on the shoulder and move the skin in a circle. And so when I got that, wait a minute, I've never seen a change in a horse that was biting and kicking because they were afraid, change from just this, like, moving skin. And so I started following that path. And a couple of months later, I was giving a workshop in Carmel Valley with about 100 people. And I always in workshops have people now I have them work on themselves, but then I would have them pick a neighbor if you want, or someone you're with, and I'll lead you through these 1 1/4 circles. And it's specifically, you take a clock off the wall and, you know, you see the numbers on the clock and you imagine that clock. And why that works with those circles is that when we imagine something, anything to do with imagination or movement, we activate the right part of the brain, which is creativity, feeling, which, oh my gosh, through COVID, so much more feeling has been shut down, and intuition and compassion. And the intuition now that I use for that has to do with the circles is it comes from a little book called Intuition by a woman named Judy, J-U-D-E-E-G-E-E, was given to me many, many years ago. And her definition makes sense to me, and I think it would to you too. And that is, intuition is the manifestation of divine consciousness within you. And to me, that means that you realize, wait a minute, what's responsible that my blood flows, you know, my lymph works, blah, blah, all this stuff that are miracles that are written so beautifully by Dr. Bruce Lipton in his books and described, you know, how the evolution of cells. Now, the reason you do that clock is because the clock has numbers. And when we imagine that we're moving around the face of the clock in these like 5 1/4 arcs, anything to do with numbers or method activates the logical part of the brain. And we couldn't get along without logical computer on the computer. But people who are only trained for left brain and trained not to trust that intuition or not to feel things and certainly not to be compassionate, man, they're really limited. And that, I think, would cause a lot of fear at some point. So that's what I know, that is what is happening. And I also know through the studies that we've done on this gentle 1 1/4 circles, is we are activating both hemispheres of the brain. And that's work that I did with The High Performance Mind is the book that we're actually, some of the studies that we did are in that book. And I recognize that when we activate both hemispheres in beta, alpha, theta, and delta, that is a study by Maxwell Cade in the 50s of consciousness, different level of consciousness. And that's what kept me like totally passionate about this work, because of those studies that we did do, that we know it's true. That's what happens when you either do the circles on your horse. And by that, I actually mean where it's not moving over the skin. That's what you would think. It's actually gently moving
that fascia around, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned fascia. With light contact with the cells. The American, the U.S. Massage Association had a 2,000-person study showing that light contact with the body activates the most oxytocin. That's the trust hormone that Bruce Lipson talks about. And also, what we've realized from the studying that we've done with this is when you smile, when you do like moving the skin, what it does is activate the feel-good hormone, the serotonin. So if you do these, what we call the heart hugs, like 1 1/4 circles, like when your heart chakra, you're in the middle, that it's just like you imagine the face of the clock, think of the wall, put the clock there, right? 6 o'clock is toward the ground, 9 toward the right shoulder, 12 to the chin, and 3 in the direction of the left shoulder. Now, why I say that is that's a method, right? And then we put those numbers there. So you get the logic, but then the gentle movement and the imagination activates the right brain. Not feeling, creativity, not intuition and compassion. And we just found through these studies that we did with Anna Wise with the Mind Mirror in 84, 85, 2009, that we're getting that activation in the person's being detached and detaching. But what's interesting, the deep work is what the study showed, like many people love, activates more of the cortisol.
More of a sympathetic type thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Fight, flight, freeze, faint, fool around.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, regular listeners to the podcast would know this. You know nothing about me. But a number of years ago, my wife bought a horse who was very, a high-level reining horse. We used to do the reining. High-level reining horse. But there was, he was very obedient, but he was very kind of inside his head and kind of shut down. And nothing that I had done up to that point in time worked on this horse. So he kind of led me to kind of look outside what I'd been doing sort of thing. But anyway, what he led me to figure out was I was shut down. And so I ended up going and doing a year of a type of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy, which was originally started for people with, it was originally invented for highly suicidal adults, but they realized it's good for anybody with any emotional regulation issues. And the whole purpose of that thing, like at the very start, it shows you these two circles that are overlapped, like a two-circle Venn diagram sort of thing. And one is the intuition side, and one is the thinking side, and that piece in the middle is what they call right thinking. And that's what you're on about here. And so this 1 1/4 circle thing, it's fascinating that you put it that way, that, you know, that it activates the thinking side of the brain, the left side of the brain, but also activates the right side, the intuition part, and the imagining I guess there's a somatic experience part to it as well, which is the part of the right brain to get you out of your thinking mind. But then you've got to think about the numbers, which is left brain. Oh, that's amazing. How you explain that makes a lot of sense. That's very cool.
Well, and the thing that's really exciting, about 15 years ago in one of our weekend trainings for self-help in Germany, a young man who was a savant in the autism spectrum came into the class and he said, you know, this one and a circle is that famous spiral that's in all of nature, that golden...
The Fibonacci sequence.
And Fibonacci is like 5 degrees short of 1 1/4. And we're just studying it right now. We've got a big study on it now. And really? that's what made me realize that, because my question is, wait a minute, how is it that a person... A child can relieve their own pain or fear with this stuff. What's going on? And through all these, you know, just really studying with these famous scientists like Bruce Lipson and Joan King, and recognizing the intelligence of the cells, I know today it's like this Fibonacci movement, this spiral, you just turn the key, and with that 1 1/4 spiral circle, you are connecting with that phenomenal intelligence in ourselves, that whatever you want to call it, source, universal intelligent, God intelligent, divine spark, that's what it is. And that's who we are. That's who we are. And when we start to give thanks to the body and moving in these light contact, we can activate that trust hormone. It's very exciting.
Very exciting. Hey, I got to ask you, so this is a podcast, so people can't see it, but you've got this amazing necklace on. What is that thing?
That is it's an octopus.
I thought it was an octopus.
Made in Hawaii. And one of the reasons when I saw this, I just had to have it because years ago, I was working with the husband of one of my, practitioners, and he would capture octopuses. Funny, they're not called octopi.
Exactly.
capture them and then send them, like one that he was sending to the Baltimore Aquarium. And I was there and I got to touch it. And when it came out of the water, it was just in a, like a pan and of shallow water. It was quite a big octopus, like that big. And if they're afraid, they change color, and the ink. But I was able to touch it so gently, it never changed color. Now, end of story, except that 20 years later, I was one of the presenters at the Baltimore Zookeepers Association. And I had all these pictures of all these different animals I've worked in various zoos around the world. And one of the aquarium people came up later and said, she knew the octopus that I had T-touched, that it came with the reputation that I had T-touched it. And she said it lived the longest of any that they had. And they just had a feeling it had a different level of consciousness. And I mean, they're so incredibly intelligent. So isn't that fascinating?
Have you seen my octopus teacher?
No. Have I seen it? Of course I've seen it. I mean, isn't that phenomenal?
It's the best documentary. Best documentary I've ever seen.
Absolutely. It's wildly wonderful.
And what's really interesting is, our friend Rupert Isaacson, I think he's just absolutely amazing. But Rupert and that guy have some sort of a connection, because Rupert spent a lot of time with the Khoi San Bushmen in the Kalahari, and that guy made a documentary on the Khoi San Bushmen in the Kalahari and spent a lot of time there. So after I watched that movie, after I watched My Octopus Teacher, I downloaded an audiobook called The Soul of an Octopus. And right at the start, I'm going to look it up here, right at the start of that book, it says that you were correct right then when you said it's octopuses, it's not octopi, because octopus is a Greek word, and it's only in Latin that you do the, cacti instead of cactuses. And
right. So
your octopus is, let me look this up, soul of an octopus. The subtitle of this book, so the book's called The Soul of an Octopus, and the subtitle is A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness.
Wow.
And it's a lot of it's in the Baltimore aquarium that you were talking about right there.
Oh, isn't that funny?
Yeah, this lady studies octopuses there. And it's not a book, not necessarily a book about octopuses, but something I learned in that book was that, the brain power of an octopus far exceeds us. I think they're actually aliens, actually. I really do think they're. But each of their limbs has a brain in it.
God.
It has its own brain, and the suckers on each limb, so they can operate each sucker independently of each other with varying amounts of pressure. Like they could pick up a bowling ball with any of them. The facts and figures about octopuses in that book were amazing. you know how they change color, like they'll go, like if they're on the bottom of the ocean in the sand, they're the same color as the sand, but as a cloud goes over them, they will change the color of them, like the clouds going over them. But the thing is, they don't see the colors with their eyes. They have photoreceptors in their skin.
No.
And that's how they match the color of the thing. So they can basically see with their tentacles, with their arms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are so much more evolved than we are. Like if you watched a sci-fi movie about, 5,000 years in the future and things can, octopuses can already do it.
I mean, it's wonderful. I actually have a book that was written about that museum, and it was given to me by Judith Ogus, who's right down there, you're pretty close to Hollister, there in Gilroy.
Very close.
Yeah, and they told me about you, and I'm so disappointed I didn't have a chance to come down and see you, but I was always just like in and out when I was there.
Oh, so we will definitely catch up one of these days. We could talk for hours, but we better cut this off. But thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I hope I surprised you, because you're probably thinking, oh, they're going to ask me how to do the things with the horses.
No, I didn't think that.
Oh,
When Rupert recommends somebody to me, it will not be about just horses. I had no expectation. That's the fun part.
That is the fun part. Yeah. Rupert, he's just an amazing human being, isn't he?
Oh my God. Unbelievable intelligence. No.
You know, the podcast I did with Rupert, actually, you were talking about things like, yes, in 1967, this happened. And then in 1972, this happened. And in 1981, this happened. For me, my conversation with Rupert was one of those things. I had something shift in me from talking to Rupert.
Not surprising. Yeah. And I am so excited that, it was in a way terrible that he had to leave Texas. But on the other hand, it's opened the rest of the world in ways that he wouldn't have done if he was just focused there.
Yeah. Yep,
amazing. Anybody who hasn't read his book, I mean, I love the first book, but the second book, if you, listener, really love language that just puts you right in the spot. Were you just blown away by the language in that book? I mean, I think it should earn a prize for literature.
Yeah, I mean, I was blown away with that. But you're talking about The Long Ride Home, not The Long Ride Home. Yes. Yes, The Long Ride Home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
What I liked about that, so I had here, or probably 6 months ago, I had a lovely lady from North Dakota. She's a Ogallala Lakota. And she actually has a PhD in psychology and is back on the reservation helping the Indigenous kids. And I was talking about, cultural appropriation and you know, what you should and shouldn't do. And she was saying, yeah, well, I said, I'm not really trying to culturally appropriate anybody's culture, but I'm interested in Indigenous wisdom and that connection to that we used to have, And she said, well, it doesn't matter where you're from. If you go back far enough, you will have that. I said, I'm mostly Irish. And she goes, well, back before Christianity, there was this, they had this connection to the earth, but we'll talk about that sort of thing. But I said, I don't think any of this stuff is cultural appropriation because I talked about Rupert's book. I said, he went to a shaman in Mongolia. She went to a Native American healer in Arizona. He went to a shaman in Botswana, one of the Bushmen, and he went to an Australian Aboriginal healer. And what's funny is the healing that they do is thousands of years old, but all four of them were very, very similar in what they did. What I mean? It wasn't like they were all completely different. And so that's the thing I'm interested in, is that collective consciousness, that shared wisdom, not, I want to be a Native American or I want to act like this or that. Right. It's like these, all four of those shamans in that book of Rupert's all did something very, very similar. Like the the sucking of the stuff out of Rowan's head, you know, the, and yeah, yeah. So that stuff just fascinates me. And I love that book, but I also love The Healing Land. Have you read that one about that Rupert wrote about the Bushmen and the Kalahari?
Oh, I did. You know, I forgot about that. I should read it again because I've been interested in the color. I've been interested ever since that little movie, not little movie, that movie about the Bushmen where they throw the bottle off the end of the
world.
The
gods must be crazy. What a good movie that was.
Oh my God, I love that movie so much. Yeah, that's when I first became interested. Yep. But
yeah,
yes, Rupert was a great gift to the planet.
Yes, he most certainly is. Okay, well, we probably should wrap this up, but thank you so much for joining me. Before we go, how does everybody find out about all things Linda Tellington-Jones?
Well, you can go to my website, which is ttouch.com. And if you want, if you're interested in the Tellington method for your dogs, for instance, my sister Robin, you met, and her and my niece Mandy Pretty have put this online, so you can now, because we have people all over the world now who don't have any chance of coming to a workshop, and you can get it online, and it's really fun. So that's called learn.ttouch.ca for Canada. CA, they're in Canada.
Okay.
And yeah, and you can also, like, I'm on Facebook, of course, Linda Tellington Jones, and we have also the T-Touch World, Tellington T-Touch World on Facebook, and we have a fun thing, actually, Warwick, that you can join for like $9.99 a month, and I have so many of my books and newsletters over the years, and I don't know, more than 100 webinars now that you can watch on all kinds of interesting subjects besides T-Touch or anything to do around horses and dogs and kitties and people. Or you can join me, and I'd love to invite you to come in just to sit in at one of my Tuesday classes. They're 2 hours, and it's T-Touch for self-care.
Oh,
and
yes,
what I do is,
I'd love to.
I lead people through T-touches for themselves to reduce fear or all kinds of pain that you can do yourself.
Really? I'm all over that. Yes. We'll chat later, but that's awesome. Well, once again, thank you so much for joining me. This has been such a fun conversation. I just love what you're doing in the world, and I think you're just making the world a better place.
Well, I hope to, you know, really meet you, and I think it would be really fun for some of us to do a workshop together in some way. It would be just like fun.
It will be. And yeah, let's put it out there. We're going to do it one day.
Or out in the universe, at least, right?
Yes, we'll do that too.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Blessings. Okay, blessings, everybody. Put everybody, it out to the world.
Everybody at home, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.